Interview with Bracisi on 28 September 1972, and now we start one with Bertil Hoogland, also at Bologna on the same day.
Well, tell me exactly how you yourself got involved in radio astronomy.
Well, it's just that I obtained my degree in electronic engineering at Chalmers, and I had always been interested in astronomy, and I would have studied astronomy had there been an astronomical faculty at the University of Gothenburg, but there wasn't, so I said, well, I just couldn't afford to study on another place than in my hometown, so that was the reason. And then I think it really took me quite some time before I knew of the existence of the radio astronomy group at all. It wasn't in the last year, the fourth year, that I knew anything about what was going on. So the practical work connected with my master's degree I did there, it was a sky survey at 150 megahertz.
You did where? At Onsala?
At Onsala, yes. They had two old mattress antennas, something like 8 by 16 meters, I think. And we were two doing this, another student.
I see.
And well, anyway, after that, I applied for a position there. And I got
right, so Rydbeck was there from the very beginning.
Yes, yes.
And that was, when was the very beginning?
For the observatory?
Yeah,
or
for Onsala.
49 or 50, something like this. I mean, this was 5 years before I started
right.
there.
Right.
They had a number of smaller antennas at the time. They had bought three of the Pittsburgh antennas from Norway, and two of them were equatorial mounted, and they had one FS. They bought them for something like 500 crowns from the Norwegian government.
I see.
Yeah, so it was very cheap. It cost them 20,000 to get them there. And, well, also they had these mattress antennas, and even when I started, they had already scrapped some even older ones that had been used, I think, for an eclipse observation. At any rate, there was an eclipse in 54.
That's right.
It was studied in Gothenburg.
A group
of people, yes.
A group from NRL, in fact, went to Sweden.
Yes, and there were French people there. I think that's when Charles Seeger first went to Sweden. Well, they observed at 3 and 10 centimeters, and I think some longer wavelengths, for 21-2, I think.
Yeah.
And actually, part of the reduction work on that I was helping with, I very far down the ladder. I think the buck had been passed on.
Yeah, right. So you were taken on as an engineer to develop
yes.
receivers?
Yes. Well, primarily one would say that, but also I think it was clear from the beginning that I should, well, when the time was right, also go into the astronomical side
mm-hmm.
of it. But, still it took many years before I did anything like that.
So what was the main thrust of the research and or development during those first few years that you were at Onsala?
Well, you mean during my first years
yes.
or the years before?
Well, if you know something about the years before, I'd like
well,
to hear about that.
Yes. I think it was mainly solar work during the first years. They had these two mattress antennas some 300-400 meters away, which they used as an interferometer. But as far as I know, not very much was ever published of the results they got there. It was more like sort of kind of practice for the future.
Right.
And there were some people who got their PhD degrees on work connected with this. There was some galactic interferometry done also, but I not on any serious scale, I would say.
No, but what do you mean by galactic interferometry?
It's not looking at sources, I mean, not the sun.
I see, oh, yeah. Not the sun.
Yeah. Yeah. I will probably remember little pieces, you know, so it probably won't be very coherent. At any rate, about half a year after I started at Onsala, I actually started in the lab in Gothenburg doing other things, and I was actually offered to join the group at Onsala a little later, when it was clear that they wanted to go into the 21 centimeter line business.
Mm-hmm.
And already the year before I started there, they had built a first 21 centimeter line receiver, and they had repeated some of the Dutch measurements. And now that we wanted to build a better receiver.
So now which year was this?
This was early 56. The new 21 centimeter receiver came into the business.
And that's when they repeated the Dutch?
No, that was earlier. That was in the summer of 55.
Right.
And roughly the time when I began there, which was in June 55. But
right.
I was not at the time connected with the things out at the observatory.
And they were still using a Würzburg dish?
Yes. This was with a 7.5 meter Würzburg. Then they had read about the DC comparison receiver for spectral line work, where you, instead of frequency switching, you have compared two bands, which you observe simultaneously.
I see.
I forgot who wrote the paper on that. The main advantage of it is that you gain a factor like, well, root of pi or square root of 2, I forgot
which, okay, right, yeah,
in sensitivity. And somehow they started to try and build a receiver on this basis. And, well, we didn't know very much about it. And also I think the big problem was that the switching was done after the first mixer. We should have switched before the mixer that is at the high frequency side. And this means that you will be very dependent on the shape of the bandpass curves. They must be absolutely flat and constant, and you know you can't do that. You couldn't at the time. So we wasted a year at least trying to get this working.
Who is we at this point?
It is Joel Aldeer. We started at Chalmers at the same time, but he graduated a year after. And the third one is Radhakrishnan, who entered the picture must have been in 56, roughly.
Right. I have talked to him, so
you
know.
Have, yes. No, okay. Well, then you know about all the... Oh, gosh.
I know some of his stories,
yes,
how he got a job and so forth.
Oh, yes. Well, that's very good.
At least I know his version of it.
Yes, yes. yeah.
So this didn't work out very well.
No.
You can't remember where I've never heard of this technique. You can't remember where that's published, the DC comparison?
Where did I read about it? There is a name which I just can't get now.
It'll
but
probably come to you.
It will probably come to me, yes. So then we decided just to rebuild it as a frequency switching receiver, which we did. Well, it still took a lot of time. I think we had it in fairly good working condition in, I forgot when, summer 57, or was it 58? I don't quite remember. And then on a hot summer's day, when we had left it unattended, maybe it was a weekend, and the fan to circulate the air in the hut had stopped operating, and there was a big heat blow, so to speak, uh-huh. to it. The wax of condensers, capacitors and things like that had melted, you know, and it was a big mess inside. And after that it took a very long time before we got it operating as well as it had done before. But, starting, say, 58 or 59, we gradually took a number of profiles.
Still with the Würzburg profile. Dish?
With the Würzburg dish, yes. And at the time when it was becoming clear what my thesis work would be, it was in connection with Betty Lindblad, who is dead now, Stockholm Observatory. It was to prove or disprove his theories about the dispersion orbits, you know, and the situation near the antecenter. So we took a lot of line profiles in the antecenter region. I forgot how many, thousands probably. Since, you know, it was a slow receiver, we had to average and
by hand. And you probably only had a couple of filters?
We had only two filters, so we observed, in the image and signal bands of the second IF. Well, still, this is really not perhaps the interesting historical part of it. Well, I should say one thing, that Rydbeck very early got interested in the 21 centimeter line after he heard about it. Either, I don't know at what stage he read van der Hult's paper. It's quite likely that he didn't know anything about it till he knew about the Dutch building their receiver, or perhaps even the discovery in 51.
Right.
But I should guess that 51 or 52 is when he tried to interest the National Research Council in Sweden to finance the hydrogen receiver. And they were negative, and as Olof tells it, it was to a large extent Hannes Alfvén who just thumbed him down, said that it would never be possible to. So this must have been before the detection, before 51.
I see. He said it would be possible to pick it up.
Yeah.
And now he's looked on as sort of a prophet after he's got the Nobel Prize.
Yes. Well, I think that this was not because he was being negative to Rydbeck's work. I think he just believed it was like that. He has supported us after that. I think it was just that he was wrong that time.
Yeah. He probably did a calculation and it didn't work out.
I don't know what he did, but anyway, Rydbeck didn't get the money, so the financial situation has been, particularly in that time there was no financial situation really.
It was a real shoestring.
Yes, right.
Well, Rydbeck was an engineer, I imagine, originally.
Well, that's right. He graduated from the Technical University in Stockholm. But, I mean, he was all the time theoretically inclined. And
right, that's what I was thinking. He seemed to have a strong feel for what was important scientifically.
Yes, that's right. And he has done mainly theoretical work, ionosphere work, largely. Well, he has built receivers and so on in the US. And, in parallel with the radio astronomy, he was having an ionospheric sounder. He had a station in Kiruna in northern Sweden, which was later taken over by the Academy of Sciences. But he was the one that started it. And all the time, one could say that up till late in the late 60s, Rydbeck himself never did any radio astronomy, but just ionospheric and plasma work.
So this was just to him a sort of an interest he had, which he tried to get money for.
Yes, I mean, he was in